Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the sex trade hurt America's children? And why are the Dallas Police Department's efforts against the problem considered a national model for best practices? A 2001 study by the University of Pennsylvania estimated that hundreds of thousands of American kids every year are at risk of sexual exploitation. Some of them are forced into prostitution. In the past, law enforcement dealt with these young sex workers strictly as criminals, who were often subject to greater penalties than the adults who paid for their service or even trafficked them. But a growing understanding of the damage inflicted on these child prostitutes is changing the way we deal with them and offers hope that in the future, fewer may suffer the physical and emotional scars inflicted by life on the streets. Investigative journalist Julian Scher explores the problem and efforts to solve it in his new book, Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. Julian, welcome to Think.
It's good to talk to you, especially on the eve of the Super Bowl.
That's right, which a lot of people are concerned will bring a lot of trafficking into this part of the country.
Absolutely. I mean, the reports are that at the last Super Bowl, there were something like 10,000 women and minors who were trafficked in and around the Super Bowl events. And to give credit where credit is due, the Texas Attorney General has already been quite outspoken, saying that Texas will try to do everything to make sure that we don't see young girls being bought and sold while people are also buying and selling their Super Bowl tickets.
You know, it's interesting, Julian, we tend to think of sex trafficking as it exists in the United States, mostly as a problem of young women brought from overseas. But in fact, you found the majority of teenage victims are American-born.
That's right. That's what first intrigued me about the story. I had done a book previously on internet predators, the men online who try to entrap our young children. And working with the Department of Justice and the FBI, after that book, they said, well, you should look at child prostitution. And I think like most people, and including I think most police officers and others, I had this image that, right, oh, it must be a horrible tragedy for these young women from Russia or Asia coming into America and being trafficked. And while, of course, that is a huge tragedy and a crime, the numbers are, we may be talking tens of thousands. One official study says it's as low as 14,000. The vast majority of the young girls who are being trafficked in our streets, whether it's in Dallas or, of course, Vegas or Atlantic City, are American girls. These are, somebody's daughter. They're from our backyard. And what fascinates me as a journalist is that our reluctance to, of course, admit it, because it's very easy to feel sympathetic or a bit of horror about, somebody abroad, as if it's somebody else's problem. But this is our problem. These are our girls.
And because of that skewed perception, this is so interesting to me, there seems to be more federal funding, more federal attention paid to international sex trafficking than to the domestic problem.
Absolutely. If a Dallas cop breaks up a child prostitution ring and finds a girl from Honduras, and right next to her there's a girl from Dallas, there are certain things that could kick in to that Honduras girl if she can be authorized as a trafficking victim, money and services and aid that doesn't necessarily kick in for that Dallas girl. And the police, one of the huge problems the police have is to find shelters and help. As you said, the rough estimate, at a minimum, we have something like maybe 300,000 young girls being trafficked as domestic, sex objects in the United States. The total number of beds, including centers like the Lipat Center in Texas, in Dallas, and elsewhere, is something like 50. So we're not taking this problem seriously, and we're ignoring these girls.
So one of the biggest risk factors for sexual exploitation of a teenager seems to be the number of times that child runs away from home. In many cases, these are kids who didn't have a stable support system even before they got into trouble.
And that's exactly what first tweaked the Dallas police. As you mentioned, the Dallas police are now seen as a model, but it wasn't always like that. And in the book, I talk about Byron Fassett, who's a sergeant, a veteran sergeant at the on the Dallas police force. And back in the 90s, he was, as he says, and you got to excuse the language, but as he says in the book, he, like most other people, said, look, I thought a whore is a whore is a whore. Hmm. And he didn't see much about these girls, and he just saw them as runaways. And he started crunching the numbers. And what he began to realize is that overwhelmingly, the girls who were being arrested as juvenile prostitutes in Dallas were in fact runaways. And not only were they runaways, they were repeat runaways. These were girls who were running away 3-4 times. So the police were arresting them, returning to their homes, and then the girls were running away. And he turned to the chief and he said, look, we don't have a prostitution problem, we have a runaway problem, and we're ignoring both. And he has this wonderful line where he said he began to realize that girls weren't running to prostitution, they were running away from something. And unless we understand what they're running away from, we're not going to solve the prostitution problem.
And the initial case that really drove this home for him is so moving. It was, a fellow officer's granddaughter was missing. Fassett was asked to help find her, and when he did, he discovered that she was a prostitute.
That's right. And he still had his as he said, his old mindset. And he kind of figured, well, she's doing this out of choice. She must want to do this. And he says, look, you could stop this and I'll try to go get the pimp. And he fails. And he sort of says, he says her eyes haunted me forever. Mm-hmm. You know, the life in her eyes were gone. And he had to go through that mental change, really a revolution in looking at these girls as victims. And he was able to make that journey, and then he got his small squad to do it, and eventually the entire Dallas police force has a model plan called the High-Risk Victims Unit, and slowly that infection, if you want, you know, that revolutionary idea is beginning to spread across the country thanks to the work of the Dallas police.
One of the things they do in the High-Risk Victims Trafficking Unit is when they have these girls come in, and I suppose there are some boys too, but it's mostly girls. The first thing they do is give them a set of regular non-prostitute clothes.
Yeah.
And they discovered that really affects a huge change in how the interview goes from there.
That's right. You know, it was partly because girls would often come in rather, you know, as you can imagine, scantily clad, mm-hmm. and the air conditioning was often, you know, quite high in the police station. So they got these sweats partly just to, you know, keep the girls warm. And then they began to realize that, you know, you take off the makeup, take off the gaudy jewelry and the clothing and dress them in the teenage sweats that, you know, my daughter or anybody's daughter would wear, and they often become the young girls that they are. And it was small steps like that. Another thing they had to fight inside the police department, was to interview these girls in their offices and not in a jail cell.
Hmm.
And, you know, as people point out, when a wife gets abused, domestic violence abuse by her husband, and might be reluctant to get away or to move away or even file a complaint, we don't lock her up. We don't jail her. We try to see her as the victim that she is. But that wasn't happening with these young girls until the Dallas High-Risk Victims Unit came into place. And words are important, too. Think about that, right? When Byron Fassett came up with the idea and called them high-risk victims, the minute you use that term instead of juvie prostitute, you know, words are important. And it changes our perception of what these girls are because they're victims. And that was really important.
And they are at high risk if they go back on the streets. Can you talk about the lifespan of a teenage prostitute? First of all, the average teen prostitute begins when she's, what, 12, 13, 14
yeah,
years old?
They estimate that the average age of entry is something like between 12 and 14.
Hmm.
It's hard to get, you know, one of the things that I think is important is that these girls don't count, and so no one's counting them. Right, we don't care enough about them to do any kind of serious survey. Even though Congress has asked the Department of Justice to do a survey, we're still not getting the high numbers. Some estimates say that life expectancy could be as low as 7 years. There's drugs, violence, psychological damage. There's a horribly scary series of photos that a police officer in Denver put together of a young girl over the space of a few months and then years, and you see what happens to her face. And various versions of that have been shown now to young girls in detention centers. It's often called the death book, so that they could see this is what they're getting into. And, of course, what's important to realize is that we're talking now of prostituted children, but what it means is that most of the prostituted adults, most of the young women who might be at the Super Bowl in early February, started off as children. So it's really a much broader problem than just the girls who are now minors.
Why is it that our society has always looked with more disdain upon the prostitute than upon the John?
I think that's a fascinating question. And you could argue, I mean, Byron Fassett makes the point that it goes back to the Bible even. I mean, look at the words that are used, you know, whether it's harlot or fallen woman, our disdain for prostitutes it goes back, you know, many, many centuries. And yet, you know, if you think about it, we're really dealing with a very lopsided triangle of trafficking. Trafficking, prostitution, it takes three parts of the triangle. You obviously need the object, the victim, and, you know, the woman, but you need, and it's almost always men, you need two men. You need the trafficker and especially the person who's buying it. And think about it like cocaine. I mean, cocaine is the product, but we try to go after the cartels that are selling it, and we go after the pushers and especially the people who are buying it. Why do we ignore? The statistics are appalling. If you look at the arrest statistics, in various cities, as much as 90% of the people being arrested for prostitution-related offenses are female, i.e., the women being trafficked, and not the pimps who are the traffickers, and especially not the Johns. And it was only recently, I mean, the Dallas cops are doing the best they can, but the FBI began to realize that, wait a minute, there's one FBI, you know, who's one of the heroes in the book as well, says they began to realize that the sex trade was the new drug trade. And so let's go after the pimps, the traffickers, the same way we go after drug traffickers. Let's treat them as a criminal enterprise, use mafia racketeering laws. And once they started doing that, they started getting convictions on some pimps for as many as 25 years or more.
Investigative journalist Julian Scher is my guest. His new book is called Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. We'll resume our conversation with Julian in a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Right now, we want to take a quick break from this really informative discussion to talk to you about supporting KERA, supporting the station that brings you content like this. As we've discussed a couple times this week, Jeff, the topics on this show, we hope, are always interesting, always informative, always fact-based, but we're not necessarily here only to entertain. We're also here to bring you things that might be hard to listen to. You know, I don't know how a commercial sponsor, if we depended on that, would feel about a topic like this. We believe it's important. We know that you believe it's important to be fully educated about the state of the world today. Your dollars make it possible. When you go online to KERA.org or when you call 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff Whittington. Welcome back.
Hey, Chris. Thank you so much. Hey, don't get the flu, no matter what you do, everybody.
Don't sit next to Jeff. I've had my shot, so
no,
I'm okay.
I'm much better now. But
you
thanks look good. Thanks to Justin Martin for filling this chair, and thanks to each of you who has responded this week. But we'd love to hear from you in support of these kinds of programs, a program where your voice is also heard. Every day when you call into the show, when you email, your questions, your answers are always welcome on Think, your thoughts, your reactions. And you know what? That's a huge part of why we do the show. It's a call-in show. It's a forum. It's here for you. It's your show. So why not support it right now with an online contribution at KERA.org safely and securely. You can do it really quickly there or call 888-694-6931. This show, if it's your favorite show, that's the perfect reason today for you to get involved with the station.
If you are interested in making a $120 contribution this afternoon, either to KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931, we do have copies available as thank you gifts of Julian Scher's book, Somebody's Daughter. Really a fascinating read, yet another book that I think would be good for a book club. Anybody who works with kids, cares about kids, has kids, even if you don't think your children are directly at risk of this sort of thing, you'd be surprised about some of the stories in there that might ring a bell for you about maybe someone that your kids know. Really interesting reading. We'll continue our discussion with Julian in a couple of minutes, but we do invite you now to call and support the station at 1-888-694-6931.
It's a very eye-opening topic, and you know, it may be tough. It may be tough to hear these conversations, but you know what? It's important that we know what's going on out there, and that's what public radio is here for you, and that's why it's here for you every day. So please go online right now to KERA.org, make a contribution, and again, $120 contribution will thank you with your very own copy of Julian Scher's book, Somebody's Daughter. But don't wait. Go to KERA.org, and please do it right now. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative journalist Julian Scher. His new book is called Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. One thing to remember here, you profile one girl in the book who found herself in very deep trouble despite the fact that she came from what most people would consider a good family. She had loving parents who were involved in her life. It's sort of a reminder not to get too complacent with regard to our own children and our children's friends. Can you tell us a little bit about Maria?
Yeah, it's a good point because while it is true that huge numbers of young girls who find themselves on the street come from what we would, stereotypically call broken homes, and they're often running away from abuse within the family, more often than not, there's some kind of trigger event that happens. And it can happen to perfectly normal middle-class kids. One of them is Maria, as you say, came from a very good Catholic family. She was in the choir at church. She felt a little distant from her parents, as young teenagers often do. And when she was very young, she asked the boyfriend of a cousin to take her out, when she wasn't allowed to go out. And she gets raped. And she makes her way home, and she keeps it secret for a couple of weeks, and then finally tells her parents, and the family goes into shock and tries to help her, but they don't know how to handle it. She doesn't know how to handle it. They go to the psychologist, drugs, and she begins that spiral. And she starts hanging around the boardwalk in Atlantic City. And she's looking for whether it's affection or love or somebody to give her something that she's lost. And she meets up with a prostituted woman who introduces her to a pimp. And Maria, at the beginning, doesn't even know the language. And then meets somebody, falls in love, as these girls often do with her pimp. And yet she always has, she says to me, she had her feet in both worlds. So unlike, she said, look, I had a home to go back to. And she would literally go back to her home and to her parents. And she'd be in school, but there'd be the whispers, and the fingers pointing to her. Oh, yeah, that's the girl who ran away. That's the girl who's a prostitute. And so she would go back to the prostitute world. And she kept going back and forth. And she was trapped, she felt, until she got arrested when she was 17 in Las Vegas. And because the Vegas cops, like the Dallas cops, spot these victims as the victims they are and realize she was a juvenile, even though she claimed to be an adult, she gets shipped back to Atlantic City. And again, lucky for her, an FBI agent who's part of that national squad we were talking about that is trained to understand these girls. They have a testy relationship for quite a couple of years. But in the end, Maria's cooperation with the FBI will help bring down a major pimping network. But it just shows, as you said, that this could be anybody's daughter. It could be there was a girl in Vegas whose mother died, and she felt a little bereft and distant from her dad, and she falls into the trap. It can be almost anything that could set a young person off into this path.
You mentioned Las Vegas, by the way. A lot of people think that prostitution is legal in the city of Las Vegas, and in fact, it is not.
It is not. I must admit, I was one of the ignorant ones. I knew it was legal in Nevada, and I kind of assumed, well, that means Vegas, because, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. But the city of Las Vegas, it is not included in the big part of Nevada where prostitution is legal. What that doesn't stop is if you walk into any hotel in Vegas and look at the Yellow Pages, and trust me, I've counted them, there are 89 pages of escort services. And the very first page has a huge full-page ad that says, barely legal teen. Hmm. And you turn the page, and then it says college teens. And, of course, it says 18 and over. But what's that message sending, right? You're basically saying, we've got young ones for sale. The Vegas cops, because that's where really the hurricane of child prostitution is occurring in the country, have rescued more than 1,500 girls in the last decade because they're looking for them. And sadly, they're finding them.
Let's talk about this issue of rescuing, because a lot of people, first of all, have a hard time looking at prostitutes as victims. And then some of these young women and girls have been indoctrinated. Maria's story is a good case of this, in a way that sounds eerily like the way people are brainwashed as they enter a cult.
I think that's very true. And one of the problems, the challenges that police and also the a collective of very heroic community workers all across the country who are trying to work with these girls, often ex-prostitutes themselves, the older women who are now trying to set up shelters and rehab programs, is that, as you know, as one police officer said in Dallas to me, the best victim is somebody who doesn't see herself as a victim. So while it's true the pimps will often use violence and guns and terror, they know their best control is to convince the girls that they love them. And what that means is that when the cops burst into the door or when the cops go into a detention center, the girls don't run into their hands and say, "Thank God you've rescued me." They hate the cops because often they've been mistreated, if not even sexually exploited by some cops.
Mm-hmm.
They still believe that their pimp loves them. And so you often, you need basically this detox. You've got to break them of their habit, of their addiction, of believing the myths that the pimp has created. And that takes a long, long time. And it can be very painful. And the police need the training, and they also need centers like the Letot Center in Dallas, where the girls can see other girls and talk and begin to break away from their pimps. But it's not easy.
And the pimps have, in many cases, quite literally branded these women as their property.
Literally branded with tattoos and their name. And think of how symbolic that is of slavery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a few independent minds like Maria. She always refused to get branded, but most will accept some kind of tattoo. You know, there's a wonderful, if somewhat discouraging scene in the book where a couple of cops are talking to a pimp before a trial, and he's willing to talk a bit, and they sort of ask him, "How many pimps are working with young girls?" And he says, "I don't like that word, pimp." And then they say, "Well, what do you want us to call you, a sexual entrepreneur, a trafficker?" And he pauses for a moment, and he says, "Street psychologist."
Hmm.
And he's right. Byron Fassett of the Dallas Police says, these pimps may not have letters after their name, but they're as smart as a PhD when it comes to being able to manipulate these girls.
We have an email here from Sean in Coppell who writes, "I'm hoping you'll talk a bit about the use of the word pimp in recent years. I'm personally hoping we can get back to a place where the word brings to mind disgusting predators instead of rhinestone-covered handbags."
That is such an important point.
Yeah.
You can go on Amazon right now. I mean, people are in front of their computers, right? Go on Amazon and put in the word pimp. Now imagine if you put in the word slave trader or trafficker. You wouldn't get an easy guide to being a slave trader or a trafficker. But you put in the word pimp, you will find a series of books, many of them bestsellers, about how to be a pimp, Pimpology, Pimpology 101. And as Amazon always does, if you like this book, you'll love these books, right?
Yeah.
And they literally talk about finding a girl who has been raped and is exploitable. All the tips you could use to keeping, and most of the words I can't even use on public radio.
Goodness.
And this is on Amazon. What was the best song of 2006 for the Oscars, right? Pimping Ain't Easy, where it talks about the difficulty a pimp has to make to make his money because the women are complaining. So the pimp culture infects all of society. Look at the rap videos. So I think it's a very good point because we have to begin to change the terminology and call them the traffickers that they are. And it goes back to where we started our conversation. Look at the disdain we have for these young girls, and yet the way Hollywood and much of our culture worships or at least downplays what the pimps are doing.
You know, I was not aware until I read your book that the actor and rapper Ice-T, who in fact plays a cop on Law & Order, not only is a former pimp, but this is not something he's ashamed of. It's something he boasts about.
I was surprised as well. And there are scenes. I went back and watched because I'm a big fan of Law & Order. I went back in scenes. In fact, there was a recent episode where he lines a bunch of pimps up because he's trying to get some information from them about a girl. And yet Ice-T, if you go on Amazon, he sells a video called Pimping 101. It's an X-rated video where he talks about different stages of pimping. And then after, there's an interview where he openly talks about his days. Now, he'll generalize and he'll say pimping, everybody, you're either a pimp or you're not a pimp, whether you're in the record industry or the acting business. He generalizes the word pimp, but he does talk about his past activity and his attitude towards women. And And I think that's just indicative. Look, Ice-T's on a poster. There's something called the Players' Ball, where the pimps around North America literally organize balls in major cities to give out Pimp of the Year awards.
This is like a convention, essentially.
Yeah, it's a convention. It's like the Oscars of the pimps, although they don't really need that. They seem to be winning the main Oscars as well. But, you know, it does go back to what our attitude is. That, and the other point we raised is the Johns. Because clearly most of the listeners, right, most of our listeners and the readers of the book may not know a pimp, but if there are something like 300,000, if not more, girls, and most of these girls are maybe, you know, servicing, you know, 5-10 men a night, just think of the numbers. Well, who are these men? You know, and as police and community activists will say, you go into the poor parts of Dallas, you'll see the BMWs driving through, you'll see the Lexuses driving through. These are men from fine middle-class families coming by to try to use these girls. And there's been surveys done. I quote in the book, I had the same stereotype of Johns as I think I did about as prostituted women. So I figured Johns were, well, maybe just losers who couldn't get a date or people who weren't in stable relationships. In fact, the surveys that have been done is that most of them are married or in stable relationship, often have children. And for them, it's a question of power, not just sex. And we've got to do something to end trafficking. There's a great chapter in the book where finally one federal prosecutor said, look, we have a federal trafficking law. You're not allowed to traffic children. Why don't we go after Johns? Because the law says you can't obtain victims of trafficking. And she devised a sting operation and got the first ever convictions of perfectly ordinary men, charged them under trafficking because they were trying to buy young children.
Julian Scher is my guest. He's an investigative journalist and author of the new book, Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. We'll resume our conversation with Julian in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Before we go back to talking with Julian Scher, we want to talk to you about the importance of supporting KERA, supporting public radio in your community that brings you a variety of different ideas about many different things. This show, Jeff, is a little bit like, I don't know, there's a lot of variety. Like, if you could have a favorite food, your favorite food could be lobster, but if you were to have to eat it all the time, you'd get tired of it. So here on the show, we cover everything. We know that you respond to that. You know, some things you might write in and say, this is my favorite topic ever. And then the next day, it might be something different that you get interested in because the guests are really interesting. Jeff and I work very hard, as does Betsy Lewis, to make sure that what you hear on the air is interesting, that the guests we have are top-notch in their field. We're proud to be able to do that for you. We love to provide this service to you. We count on your financial support at kera.org to make it possible.
Yeah, the station does require financial support of listeners to operate, because that's part of the deal. That's how public radio stations are set up. Our license from the FCC and our nonprofit status, not-for-profit business status with the IRS, demands that we ask you to support the station. And that's what we're doing this week and next week and a little bit of last week. And we've made great progress. If you have done your part to support KERA, thank you so much. We've heard from hundreds of people, but we're still waiting to hear from you. Don't expect that someone else is going to step up in your place. If you were all in a room together, and I think if we said, hey, who wants to support the station, who wants the service to continue, many of you would raise your hands. And you know what? Even if you hesitated at first or you thought about it for a little while, when you looked around and saw that there were a lot of people like you, people that you could identify with, that were standing up and raising their hands, you know what? You'd probably join them. Well, that's what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to join with all the other people, people that are different from you and similar to you in many different ways. But the thing you have in common is that you love KERA and you listen to KERA. We're asking you to join those people by going to kera.org, making a contribution there, or make a contribution over the phone at 888-694-6931. It's absolutely crucial that you do your part, because if you don't, and then somebody else doesn't, and then no one does, eventually there's no public radio. There's no public radio station in North Texas because no one would support it. So please do your part right now. Please be the next one to go online to KERA.org or to call 888-694-6931.
You can choose a copy of Julian Scher's book, Somebody's Daughter, if you make a contribution today at the $120 level. You know what I was thinking about, Jeff, the other day as I was driving home from work, mm-hmm. listening to some of our colleagues raising funds for the station.
You were thinking, gosh, I'm glad I'm not having to do that right
no,
now.
No, you know what I was thinking? I know okay. that people, you may be one of them, people sometimes talk about how here at in public radio we beg for money. And people mm-hmm. talk about, I hate hearing all that begging. We know we're on social media. We know that you say it. And some of you say it sort of fondly and jokingly. And some of you are just incensed by this, by the fact that we ask for money. The truth is, if you are somehow listening all the time, loving the content, and refusing to make a contribution, what it ends up is we're not begging from you. We're begging for you because you're benefiting from the fact that someone else gave money. I mean, if you wouldn't go next door to your next door neighbor and say, hey, can you please, you know, give me some money so that I can listen to public radio? If somehow it wasn't available to you, you would just find the money and send it in.
That's absolutely right. Chris, can I borrow $5, though?
I believe I still owe you $5 from something a couple years ago, and I can't remember now why, but this hangs over my head forever.
You do. And I'd rather keep it that way, actually, to be honest.
You get $5 worth of Chris Boyd.
But for you out there, we really would rather not keep it that way. I mean, for a while we've been saying, hey, you know, you've been listening, and, you know, you in the back of your mind, you know, oh, gee, I do owe the station. And people come up to me, and I'm sure they do to you too, Chris, and say, gosh, when is the beg fest going to end? But you know, a lot of times people will say,
when you
well,
make a contribution, is
yeah,
what it ends.
But people say, you know, I gave. I listened, but, you know, I gave. And you know what? You know it's important. If you listen to the station, you know it's important for you to support the resource. It's just somehow we haven't managed to convince you to do your part just yet. And I don't know what the magic word for you is. If we did, you know, the drive would be over. Just please don't wait. Please do your part right now, because you realize that when you say to someone who works at the station or who listens to the station or who you know supports the station, when you say, oh, I listen to the station, and they look at you, you think that they're probably thinking it, even if they're not, did you give? Did you give to the station? Did you support the station as well? Because you know you want to be able to say it. You want to be able to say, I listen and I give. Call us, 888-694-6931.
It's wonderful to make a contribution. This is tax deductible, you should know. You can choose thank you gifts if you're interested online at kera.org. You can also call us at 1-888-694-6931. We would love to be able to read your name on the air and thank you personally if you make a contribution. So let the folks know when you make your pledge if that's something that you're interested in. If not, we don't have to read your name. If you want to make a $120 contribution or more today, among the thank you gifts you can choose is Julian Scher's book. It's called Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. Really interesting, really inspirational account of what's taken place here in the city of Dallas. Something that I think a lot of people ought to read and would be interested to read. We would love to hear from you now at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Julian Scher. He's an investigative journalist and author of the new book, Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We hear now from Idrissa, who writes, there was recently a featured piece on All Things Considered about child sex trafficking. I was appalled by the rude comments many men made about trafficked girls on the NPR website. There's a lot of apathy out there, and the whole experience made me realize we have a long way to go before ending the scourge of this form of child abuse. Did you find, Julian, that in your research there were people who still couldn't become sympathetic to the idea that trafficked children are victims?
Yes, And not only among sort of the abusers or the exploiters, you know, the attitude towards the pimps, or as the listener emailed the Johns. In fact, if you look forget just NPR web comments, there are web boards where Johns talk about the best places to go for young girls. Mm. I'm sure around the Super Bowl there's plenty of chat about where to go and where to pick up whatever you're interested in. So it could be quite appalling. But what was even just as disheartening, there was an excerpt of my book that ran on a website that would be, you know, open to supporting women's rights. And some of the comments were saying, I sympathize with these girls, but they had a choice. There's no gun to their head. Why didn't they run? And that's a very common attitude. And think about it. Remember the Elizabeth Smart story, right?
Yeah.
This young girl who was kidnapped. There were times where she could have escaped, right? She could have run across the street, right? She was out in the open. But she didn't, and there was not a condemnation of her because people realized there was a combination of being brainwashed and being frightened by her abductors. And yet we don't have that attitude towards the young girls caught up in Dallas and across the country. And I think what people don't understand is, well, what does choice mean? I mean, if your choice is staying with your pimp or running home where your uncle or your stepfather is abusing you, is that a choice? If your choice is you're out on the street and there's no jobs, the police are treating you like trash because they're not trained the way the Dallas cops are to see you as a victim, is that a choice? And even if you finally get the courage to realize this pimp is really messing with me and I've got to break free, to go where? There are no shelters. There are no rehab programs. And finally, what I say is, look, just think, it's been a long time since I've been a teen, but I made a lot of bad decisions when I was a teenager. And I had a loving family and an economic support. But some of those decisions could have been costly. But should the decisions we make as teenagers condemn us for the rest of our lives, even if we do make a bad choice? And I think it really comes to a change of attitude, like, you know, Byron Fassett. It took an individual cop, a sergeant, to just say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with the way we're treating these girls. And once he began to change his view and change the view of the cops, what's so remarkable, what they're doing in Dallas, is Byron and his team are literally talking to every single officer. Every single officer in the Dallas Police Force is being trained to look at these girls differently. Well, if the Dallas police can do that, then why can't we do that? Why can't we do that in our schools, in our churches, and in our synagogues, and in the media?
You have an amazing case study in the book of a Dallas girl that you call Felicia, who testified against her pimp. We should start by saying getting involved in sex trafficking was hardly the first terrible thing that had ever happened to her.
That's right. Felicia is all too typical. She had bad health problems, mental disorders. She was on a whole slew of drugs. She said, I was hearing voices. But, you know, she was a determined little girl, kept running away, and as happened, was always brought back to her home. Her mother would keep reporting her as a runaway. She was being abused by a man in the house. And she finally gets viciously beaten by a pimp. She runs away. By this time, it's more than 10 times. Finally meets up with a pimp at the Dallas bus station. And at one night, I describe in unfortunately quite graphic detail the cigarette burns and the stabbings and the violation that she has to put up with. Finally, she escapes and, believe it or not, goes home. The police are there, and what do? They arrest her because she's violated probation for being a runaway, and they bring her to a detention center. But luckily, this was not the Dallas police. But because of the work that Byron Fassett and the others had done, they meet her in the detention center. They believe her story, unlike everybody else. And they begin to go after the pimps who tortured her. But then she has to go through another ordeal. She has to testify. And there's an amazing scene where one of the pimp sort of says, you know, she's just a hoe. You're doing all this for a hoe? And Kathy De La Paz, one of the Dallas cops, turns to him and says, she's not your hoe anymore. And then this girl, who's barely a teenager, has to have the courage to stand up and testify. But what it means, of course, is that she's now put on trial. In front of those jurors, the defense lawyer, as he has to, it's his only case, is trying to blame her. And he puts in the minds of the jurors, well, was that door locked? And she says, no. So you could have escaped any time. You could have left any time. And it took the prosecutor, Tim Gallagher, who's now one of the senior prosecutors running organized crime in the Dallas attorney's office, he sort of said, we have to speak up for this girl. If we don't, as ordinary people in Dallas, see what made her do what she had to do and see her courage. And luckily, 12 people in Dallas saw through the myths and the prejudices they had against young victims, saw the pimp for what he was, and sentenced him for something like 75 years. But it says a lot. Think of that journey that that girl had to do. She's doing well now. She's with her sister out of state. But if not for a change of attitude by the police, if not for a courageous prosecutor who could take the time to educate the jurors, how many other Felicias are out there who aren't getting that attention?
During this time that the trial was being prepared for and everything, Felicia turned 16, and there's a story in there that, as a parent, I couldn't even imagine. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, at one point, Kathy, one of the Dallas officers, noticed from the records that her birthday's coming up. Goes, oh, it's 16, so she goes out and gets a cake for her, and they bring the cake in during one of their meetings. Right, they set up at one point they bring in the cake with the candles, and Felicia's there, and she's just staring in front of the cake. She doesn't know what to do, and then they say, well, blow the candles, and she blows the candles, and she has her eyes closed, but she still doesn't know what to do. And then they realized she's 16 years old. She had never had a birthday party. She had never had a birthday cake. She literally did not know what to do with that birthday cake. So it shows, the kinds of girls. Think how vulnerable that kind of girl is for a pimp. But then look at the darker side. Within a few days after that, she's supposed to go testify. And according to the rules, she's supposed to be wearing chains. Literally, chains on her arms and her feet because she is wanted. She was serving time because she had violated her probation conditions as a runaway. And the Dallas cops, and she's supposed to be wearing a uniform, a detention uniform. And Kathy runs out and gets clothes from her, from the store and from her own family. And then they have to fight with the judge and the court rules to say, why should she be in chains? And the pimp who violated her walks in a nice-looking business suit. And they had to fight and force the court to change its rules so that she could be dressed as the young girl that she was. So it still shows how far we have to go to change our attitudes.
Julian, what do we do to spot and help people who might be in trouble? Is there something that regular people could see in the eyes of a girl who's threatened in this way?
Well, yes. I mean, it is. We're not experts, so obviously seek help with people who are experts.
Right.
In my book and on my website, I give lots of numbers where you can phone. There's national groups, and in Dallas, there's groups like the Letot Center and something like the Dallas High-Risk Victims Unit, which will answer calls 24/7. So there are places to go. But I think the key is what I began to realize and what police and social workers began to realize is give these young women something that they're not getting, either from where they're running from and certainly not from when they're on the street, and give them respect and dignity. And if you treat them, not as the adult, because they're not adults, they might think they're adults, but give them the respect and dignity that they're due. And don't be judgmental. And it's wonderful to see these FBI agents who are dealing with girls who will often still be on the street. And the good police officers will always say, I'll never judge her. Even if I think what she's doing is wrong, I'll say, hey, I think what you're doing is wrong and it's dangerous for you, but it's not judgmental. It's not putting her down. And they begin to realize, as one girl said, Maria, that we talked about, she began to realize that this FBI agent was the first man who didn't want anything from her and wasn't judging her. And I think that's what we should do as parents, as concerned citizens, and as people concerned in our community. Because, again, it goes back, these are somebody's daughter. They're all somebody's daughter. And we have to treat them like that.
Julian, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it was an honor. And I'd be glad to sign any of the books that people want. It would be great to help your fundraising.
Really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
The new book by investigative journalist Julian Scher is called Somebody's Daughter, The Hidden Story of America's Prostituted Children and the Battle to Save Them. We do have copies of this book available if you're ready to make a $120 contribution or more to KERA to support public radio in your community. You can do that by going online to KERA.org. org, or if you prefer to pick up the phone, you can call 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington, hello.
Hey, Chris Boyd, and hello to you. Thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks so much for sticking with us through a week of the membership campaign, a little over a week. And thanks especially if you have been motivated to go ahead and take that next step and go to KERA.org, make a contribution there, or to call 888-694-6931. Just to clear up any misconception, that we didn't have Julian in the studio today, so it's difficult for us to get a signed copy of his book. But I bet if you get the book through his website, you can arrange to get your copy signed if you'd like to do that. It was very generous of him to offer that there at the end of the show. But we'd love to have you participate in the station today, and we can send you a copy of his book, Somebody's Daughter, at the $120 membership level.
I want to say thanks to Trudy and Joseph Green Bishop in Euless, Leonardo Nicaulo in Fort Worth, Stephanie Jacoby in Frisco. Thanks to all of you who are calling and going online right now to make a contribution. Your dollars keep radio going. Forever, if you've been listening forever and you haven't made a contribution and you thought, well, they've done fine without me thus far, it's been a tough year for a lot of folks. And maybe this is the time that you step up, knowing that someone out there who has been a loyal subscriber to this station, maybe for this time has to beg out.
Yeah, if you're a stalwart listener and a stalwart believer in public radio and public media, and you think that it's crucial and it's vital, but you have yet to call or have yet to go online to support the station, I would ask you to consider your position, because we all have things that we do and services that we use, but there are very few things that we really believe in. There are very few magazines or newspapers or television stations that share our values, or radio stations for that matter, since we're talking about radio today, that share our values. But when you tune to public radio, you know you're going to find a place where everyone's treated with respect, regardless of their point of view. And, you know, everybody comes to the table here with an open mind and an open opportunity to converse and to have a really viable discussion, a constructive conversation about an issue. That includes you when you call into the show, or when you email into the show, or just when you listen at work or in your car or at home. That's what public radio is all about. That's what KERA is all about. We know that that's what you're all about too. So there are a couple of times a year, and this is one of those times when we're in a membership campaign period, when it really is crucial that we hear from you, that you take one more step rather than just be a listener, that you become a supporting listener of the station. It's so easy to do, but you have to do it.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go online and make a contribution at KERA.org. I have to say, I have worked in commercial media, and I had great experiences there, and I really, really love public radio and public television. It is kind of a safe haven for me as a journalist, though, to work here, knowing that I am not required to create conflict where none exists in order to keep the ratings up and in order to sort of make people look foolish. I love the idea that the expectation here is that we will respect all of our guests. That's not to say we'll never challenge or say, wait, explain this, or please help me understand. But it's not my job to make people look foolish. It's my job to understand why they believe what they believe, and hopefully to bring you to that understanding. It's also nice that in public radio, it's really not about us. It's not the Chris Boyd show. It's not the Jeff Whittington show. It is really about the guests that we have every single day. And it's delightful, because you waste a lot of time if it's all about you. And instead, this is time that we can give to wonderful guests like we had Cheryl Wudun yesterday and Julian Scher today, and all the others that you've heard over the years. Your support of the public radio model really makes it possible. 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org.
Yeah, if this was a commercial radio station, we would have spent maybe 3 to 5, maybe even 7 minutes with Julian Scher, and the tease would have been something like, thousands of probably thousands of sex slaves brought into the DFW area for the Super Bowl. Is your child at risk?
Now, we should say there are really good journalists working
Absolutely.
In these venues, but they're under a lot of pressure.
Right. But how do we present the opportunity to talk to somebody like Julian Scher? It's what is the issue? What are the actual, all the facts, as many of the facts as we can get in? And honestly, because we're in the membership campaign, we spent a little less time with him today than we normally would have on the show. And really, most of the time, the 48 and a half minutes of talk time that Chris has with the guest still isn't enough. It's incredible that there's so much to talk about. And even we feel like we're not able to get that far. And that's why we come back to a topic over and over again with different points of view, different guests, and make sure that we hit a bunch of different sides of an issue over time on the show, because we think that you're worth it. We think that you're worth that kind of investment in a topic, that kind of investment of the time and resources of this company, because you, the audience, are the most important aspect of the programming and the station. When we come to you at this time and say, look, this is what you get from public radio, as opposed to the great journalists, and don't get me wrong, who work in commercial broadcasting, you know, we ask that instead of going out and buying a product from a company that supports the station, we ask that you just support the station directly.
Yeah, your money makes it possible for us to spend this time on the content, so that instead of a 2-minute or a 5-minute or a 7-minute piece, we're able to devote an hour to a subject. And as Jeff said, come back to it from different perspectives multiple times. Your money allows this, because we don't have to use that time on commercials. If you would like to join the people who make public radio in this community possible, over 2,200 so far, 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go online at kera.org. Our goal for today is to raise a total of $50,000 during this day. Your contribution of $50 or $100 or $500 makes it possible. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.